8. Part 2. Conception and Birth. 5. 89001. There were two separate but overlapping fields upon which I would work out my attempt to perform a human DMT study. One was the clinical research realm, the other was regulatory. In this chapter, I will focus on the science of the study, the actual research proposal. The next chapter will describe the labyrinth of boards and agencies through which the protocol passed. The Human Research Ethics Committee at the University of New Mexico reviews any project intending to study humans. This committee stamps all such proposals with a number. The first two digits correspond to the year, and the next three digits reflect the order in which the protocol arrives. I submitted the DMT proposal in late 1988. It was the committee's first study up for review at their January meeting. Thus it became 89001. The first sentence, which I'd spent hours writing and rewriting the month before, trying to find the perfect opening line, read, "This project will begin a re-examination of the human psychobiology of the tryptamine hallucinogen of abuse, N-dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is also an endogenous hallucinogen." It was nearly 2 years later, on November 15, 1990, before the U.S. Food and Drug Administration wrote to me stating, "We have completed our review and have concluded that it is reasonably safe to proceed with your proposed study." I already had some experience with the difficulties involved in giving an abusable, mind-altering drug to humans. This was from submitting a protocol to the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, several years before deciding to attempt a DMT study. The drug in this case was MDMA, popularly known as ecstasy, a stimulant drug with mild psychedelic properties. In the early 1980s, a loose-knit network of therapists was giving this drug to their patients as an aid to psychotherapy. It was not illegal, and these psychiatrists and psychologists found that its effects were more reliable and easier to use than those of LSD. To their dismay, this wonder drug, like LSD decades before, soon became widely abused across college campuses. In addition, scientific papers began reporting that MDMA caused brain damage in laboratory animals. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, placed MDMA into the most restrictive legal category for drugs, Schedule 1, in 1985. Nearly all the therapists using MDMA tried to make the DEA reverse its opinion. I went a different route and requested permission to give MDMA within its new legal status. I submitted an application to the FDA in 1986. I proposed to give MDMA to human volunteers and measure its psychological and physical effects. When they sent me their standard, "You may proceed if you don't hear from us in 30 days," letter, I thought to myself, "Great, I'll be able to start the research within a month." However, like clockwork, the FDA called after 29 days and said I couldn't begin yet. Soon a letter came detailing their concerns about the neurotoxic effects of MDMA. They didn't know when there would be enough information to allow me to go ahead. It might be quite a while. My MDMA application languished in the FDA files and never amounted to much. However, I did learn that the FDA was a large and rather conservative organization. They had to be. This was made clear to me during an informal conversation with Dr. L., the director of the FDA division responsible for reviewing my MDMA proposal. Dr. L. and I were attending a scientific meeting in 1987. We happened to be standing near each other during a coffee break. Introducing myself, I asked him if he would consider allowing me to study MDMA in the terminally ill, since he had concerns about long-term brain damage in normal volunteers. In what now seems a somewhat cavalier and callous manner, I told him that these issues wouldn't be as much of a problem in those with a 6-month life expectancy. In addition, I added gamely, It would be an opening into some psychotherapy work with the terminally ill. Dr. L. replied matter-of-factly, "Even the terminally ill have rights, and you don't want to waste their death. And besides, sometimes the diagnosis of terminal is wrong." He wrote me later to reaffirm his opposition to any MDMA studies involving dying patients. Years later, halfway through the DMT study, the FDA sent me a letter asking if I'd like to cancel the request for an MDMA permit. It seemed like a good idea, so I agreed. As my melatonin project began revealing the unmistakably timid psychological effects of this pineal hormone, I decided to visit a close friend and colleague, one whose opinions I valued regarding these matters. Sitting up in the loft of his Northern California home in August 1988, we spent a day sorting through a wide range of approaches with which to frame a human psychedelic research project. By sunset, we arrived at two relatively simple but solid conclusions. First, DMT clearly was the drug to study. It was incredibly interesting, and we all had some circulating in our bodies. Second, any psychedelic research project must not conflict with, and in fact must be consistent with, the current concerns about drug abuse. The U.S. government was spending billions of dollars contending with the problems associated with out-of-control substance use. Surely some of that money could fund a human DMT study. Rather than fighting against the government by trying to remove legal restrictions, it made more sense to appeal directly to the scientific thinking that ultimately drives research. We all wanted to know what drugs like DMT did, and how they did it. My psychedelic colleagues weren't especially optimistic about a DMT project's chances for success. The MDMA affair had demoralized many. "You know what?" one predicted. "The only paper you'll ever write is how you couldn't do it. Look at how your MDMA protocol fared." However, I had been working alone in my MDMA project. For the DMT study, I had the support and advice of Daniel X. Friedman, MD. I met Danny Friedman in 1987 at one of the many scientific meetings I was beginning to attend. Such conferences and the networking occurring at them is part of the ritual of establishing a successful research career. A diminutive gnome-like man, Dr. Friedman was arguably the most powerful individual in American psychiatry at the time. He began his career in the psychiatry department at Yale University, studying LSD in laboratory animals. He later moved on to become chairman of the psychiatry department at the University of Chicago. By the time I met him, he had moved again and was professor and vice chairman of psychiatry at the University of California in Los Angeles. He had been president of the American Psychiatric Association as well as of every major biological psychiatry organization. Rather than take a government health position, he chose to wield his power as the editor of psychiatry's most influential academic journal, the Archives of General Psychiatry. He routinely made and dashed careers by accepting or rejecting any one of the thousands of papers aspiring researchers endlessly submitted to him. Friedman trained dozens of top-flight researchers in academics and industry. He made late-night calls to anyone he liked to discuss the latest research ideas or political developments. He possessed unlimited energy and seemed to require almost no sleep. He chain-smoked cigarettes and drank endless quantities of frighteningly strong coffee. Seductive and charming, he could also lash out unpredictably if you aroused his ire. His 1968 paper on the use and abuse of LSD was a seminal article in my thinking. I admired his no-nonsense but open-minded approach to clinical psychedelic research. While he had worked with schizophrenic patients under the influence of LSD in the 1950s, he nearly exclusively performed animal studies. His early animal pharmacology papers on LSD established the groundwork for future laboratories' approaches to assessing the role of serotonin in psychedelic drugs' effects. He also testified in front of the 1966 U.S. Senate committee, chaired by Senator Robert Kennedy, that sealed the fate of psychedelic drugs' placement into their restricted legal category. Friedman had serious doubts about the possibility of performing good human psychedelic research. He believed volunteers had too many expectations of drug effects. He also was worried about the risk of unreliable personnel, a euphemistic reference to drug-taking by members of a research team. This latter concern unerringly predicted some of the problems our own group would encounter in New Mexico. In our meetings and correspondence, Friedman predicated any help he would provide me upon the premise that my DMT research would focus solely on pharmacology. He thought psychotherapy research would result in irrational enthusiasm, questionable results, and scientific controversy. It was safer and more practical first to confirm and extend the wealth of data coming from animal laboratories. While his logic was unassailable, our adherence to this biomedical model did set the stage for certain problems that developed later on in our research. With Dr. Freeman's guidance, I wrote up a DMT study, the Dose Response Project. It was simple, level-headed, and achievable, containing four specific goals: recruit well-functioning, experienced hallucinogen users for volunteers, develop a method to measure DMT in blood, create a new rating scale by which we could assess DMT's psychological effects, and characterize psychological and physical responses to several doses of DMT. After briefly summarizing the history of psychedelics within academic psychiatry, I pointed out that while animal studies continued, human experiments lagged far behind. Psychedelics continued to be popular drugs of abuse, and understanding what they did and how they did it would address real public health concerns. I also reviewed previously published animal and human data on DMT and listed the qualities that made it an ideal candidate with which to resume human psychedelic drug research. I noted that one of the best reasons for choosing DMT was that very few people had heard of it. When the media discovered my research, it would draw much less attention than would an LSD project. Next, I exhumed the endogenous psychotomimetic argument, arguing that scientists had yet to find any better candidate for a naturally occurring schizotoxin. Researchers were developing new antipsychotic drugs that blocked the same serotonin receptors that psychedelics activated. Thus, the more we knew about DMT, the more we might learn about psychotic disorders. If we could block the effects of DMT in normal individuals, perhaps we would have a new weapon in our armamentarium against schizophrenia. I also proposed that DMT's short duration of effects would make it easier to use than longer-acting drugs, especially in the potentially negative setting of a hospital environment. Finally, DMT had a track record of safe use in previously published human research, especially that of Dr. Zara. This introduction led to the theoretical underpinnings for studying DMT, the biomedical model. Psychopharmacologists had firmly established that psychedelics, including DMT, activated many of the same brain receptors as did serotonin. Laboratory animal research, continuing for decades after human studies ended, revealed the specific types of serotonin receptors involved. I was to build upon this animal data and determine if it also applied to humans. The most important biological variables were to be neuroendocrine in nature. Neuroendocrinology is the study of how drugs influence hormones by first stimulating certain brain sites. For example, activation of specific serotonin receptors in the brain causes a rise in blood levels of particular pituitary hormones, such as growth hormone, prolactin, and beta-endorphin. The hormones that change in response to drugs reflect which brain receptors those drugs affect. Serotonin receptors also regulate heart rate, blood pressure, body temperature, and pupil diameter. I would measure these, too, in an attempt to thoroughly catalog other signs of serotonin receptor activation by DMT. These were objective, numerical data. I would recruit only experienced psychedelic users for the study. Experienced volunteers would be better able to report drug effects than those with no idea what to expect. In addition, seasoned research subjects were less likely to panic under the influence of the extremely powerful effects of DMT, which potentially would be more disorienting in the stark clinical research center environment. Finally, there were unpleasant but real liability issues. I had to protect myself from any lawsuits that might result if people claimed they began using psychedelics because of their participation in the study. If they had used psychedelics in the past, it would be more difficult for them to claim the study had introduced them to these drugs. Volunteers also would be required to be functioning at a relatively high level, working or in school and in stable relationships. This would help assure me that they were grounded enough in everyday reality to handle what would be a rigorous and demanding study. I wanted them to have support from sources other than the research team to whom they could turn if they needed help outside of the sessions. There would be careful medical and psychological screening of the volunteers. Women must neither be pregnant nor likely to become pregnant, and we would test urine for recreational drugs before every study day. In reviewing the techniques for measuring psychedelics' psychological effects, I concluded that all previous questionnaires presumed their effects to be unpleasant and psychotic. A newer scale with less of a bias based on responses in people who liked psychedelics might provide a broader perspective on their effects. I proposed interviewing as many recreational DMT users as I could for this purpose. These individuals would provide a broad overview of DMT's effects, which would form the basis of a new rating scale. As the research progressed, I could appropriately modify the questionnaire. It also was necessary to develop an assay or method of measuring for DMT in blood. There were several older assays from which to choose, and we would try our hand at whichever seemed easiest and most sensitive. The most likely method was one used by researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health, the same group that had written the Decent Burial paper on DMT. Based on a 1976 study describing hormone effects of DMT in humans, we calculated that 12 volunteers were enough to show statistically significant differences between doses of DMT and an inactive saltwater placebo. Most dose-response studies of any new drug give volunteers one high dose, one low dose, and one or two medium doses in order to describe the entire spectrum of effects. I wanted to give as much DMT as possible, so I decided that each volunteer in the study would receive a placebo and four doses of DMT, one high, one low, and two medium. Volunteers would receive the different DMT doses in a randomized and double-blind manner. Randomized means that the sequence of doses is in no particular order, as if a roll of the dice determined which day would involve any particular dose. Clifford Qualls, Ph.D., the University of New Mexico General Clinical Research Center's biostatistician, generated a random sequence of the required doses on his computer, sealed it in an envelope, and delivered it to the pharmacy for their use. Double-blind means that neither the volunteers nor I would know which dose any volunteer was to receive on any particular day. Only the pharmacist possessed the list detailing the unique ordering of doses for each person. The purpose of randomized double-blind studies is to reduce the role of expectation in affecting results. In Chapter 1, I referred to the classic study demonstrating the power of expectation in determining drug effects. Similarly, if volunteers knew when they were going to get a low dose of DMT, their responses might be biased. They might react in a way consistent with what they expected a low dose to be like, rather than what actually happened, be it in reality a placebo or a medium dose they received that day. In addition, before entering into a complicated double-blind study, we thought it best to begin a volunteer's involvement in the research by first giving them two non-blind doses of DMT. An introductory low dose of 0.05 milligrams per kilogram would let people settle into the research setting without having an effect so strong that it might disorient them. A subsequent high dose 0.4 megagrams per kilogram would let volunteers experience the greatest level of intoxication they would ever reach on any subsequent double-blind day. We called this the calibration dose. If someone received their first high dose in the middle of the full study but didn't know it was the most they'd ever get, they might drop out for fear of getting even more of an effect on another dose. With a non-blind high dose, volunteers had the option of dropping out of the study right away, before we had begun collecting a lot of data on them. So subjects actually would receive 6 doses of DMT, 2 non-blind and 4 double-blind. Tests of new drugs always include a placebo, and our study would too. Placebo-controlled studies further help tease apart the effects of anticipation from those of the drug. Placebo comes from the Latin meaning, I shall please, or to paraphrase, I shall meet your expectations. Most of us think of a placebo as an inert substance, what we refer to as inactive placebo. Sugar pills are the best-known example of inactive placebos. In our DMT studies, the inert placebo was sterile salt water, or saline. Practically speaking, it is extraordinarily difficult to keep double-blind placebo-controlled studies double-blind. Effects of active drugs are usually much more obvious than those of inactive salt water or sugar, and both research subjects and staff almost always can tell the difference. However, in this first dose-response DMT project, we wanted to use a placebo to see if volunteers and we could distinguish between the lowest dose of drug and none at all. In that capacity, the placebo day served a valuable function. There were drawbacks to this design. Volunteers usually felt substantial anxiety before getting their first double-blind dose. Was today going to be another shattering high dose, or could they relax? If it was apparent that the first few double-blind sessions did not involve the large dose, anxiety also built up before later sessions in a way that didn't for those who got the high dose out of the way on an earlier day. While the randomized order in which all volunteers received their full complement of doses probably statistically evened out this factor, at a human level, there was a price to pay. I also addressed how we would manage psychological and physical adverse effects. The first line of response to a panic reaction would be talking people down using reassurance and support. If this didn't work, we would use a minor tranquilizer, such as injectable Valium. We would use an injection of a major tranquilizer, like Thorazine, if anyone got completely out of control. For allergic reactions, such as wheezing or a severe rash, an intravenous antihistamine was available. If blood pressure went up too high, nitroglycerin tablets under the tongue, much like the way people with angina heart pain use them, would be effective. I attached a list of several dozen references supporting the ideas I had laid out. These included papers from the first wave of human psychedelic research. There were articles describing what we knew about psychedelics' effects on animals and on serotonin receptors. Anticipating concerns about safety, I pointed to my previously published review of adverse effects of psychedelics. In it, I suggested that if people were mentally healthy, well prepared, and closely supervised before, during, and after the experience, the chances of serious and prolonged psychiatric side effects were extremely low. Copies of the proposal went to all the boards that had control over human drug abuse research, including the Human Research Ethics Committee at the University of New Mexico, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. The study would occur at the University of New Mexico Hospital's General Clinical Research Center, so I sent a copy of the proposal there as well. The research center might cover the costs of measuring the large number of blood samples for DMT and hormone levels, so I also submitted a budget to their laboratory. Now for the hard part. Getting everyone responsible for overseeing and funding this project to agree it was safe was worth doing and deserved money.